I'm Marty Moscow, and welcome to Radio Times. U.S. government officials will be going to Puerto Rico next month to help the American territory address its financial problems. It has a mountain of debt, its bonds have been downgraded, it has a high rate of unemployment, and its economy is in the eighth year of a recession. So how did Puerto Rico get into this fix, and what is the way out? We have two guests who have joined us. Dan Rosenheck is former Latin American correspondent for The Economist, just got back from Puerto Rico. And Dan, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us is Denica Cotto, and she's a Caribbean-based Associated Press editor and reporter covering the Caribbean and joins us from Puerto Rico. And Denica, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you for having me.
Dan, let me start with you and actually start with the fact that Puerto Rico is in its eighth year of a recession, obviously predating the recession here on the mainland. That takes us back to 2005 and 2006. What sparked this recession?
It's really the sort of culmination of a trend that goes back 30 or 40 years, which is that Puerto Rico developed basically as an offshore manufacturing hub, above all for the pharmaceutical industry, spurred by generous tax breaks from the U.S. At a time when it had exclusive access to the mainland market and really not much competition from abroad. Now, the world changed. Singapore and Ireland in particular have become very fearsome competitors. America has signed free trade deals with other countries, but Puerto Rico hasn't. It's still trying to compete basically in fairly low value-added manufacturing in the same industries, and it's lost a lot of its edge, and so that's led to a lot of unemployment and people leaving the country.
And Danica, the unemployment rate in Puerto Rico is something like 14%, twice the rate on the mainland.
Correct. There's been a lot of jobs lost, and the unemployment rate, has remained high for the previous 7 years. And Puerto Rico, again, you know, as Dan mentioned, is trying to stem that flow of professionals and of young people going to the U.S. mainland.
And is that who's leaving the country, or leaving the territory?
Correct. There's a mix. Obviously, the biggest concern is the number of professionals leaving the island. There's an estimated more than 500,000 Puerto Ricans have left in the past decade. And there's about 76,000 alone in 2011, and then another estimated 61,000 in the previous year. And a lot of those, you know, are teachers, educators, lawyers, doctors, and obviously young people. And so Puerto Rico's trying to stem that tide. A lot of them are going to Florida, New York, and actually Pennsylvania is the third popular destination.
So who is left on Puerto Rico, Danica?
Well, currently there is still, you know, a working middle class and a lower middle class that's struggling, as well as a middle class. And there's a lot of educators still here. There's still, you know, doctors and lawyers. But again, economists are saying, as well as government officials, expressing concern about how the top people in their profession have left or are planning to leave.
Dan, let me go back to you and talk just about Puerto Rico's debt. How help us understand, I guess, the magnitude of the debt, something like $70 billion.
It's important to sort of compare apples to apples. If you look at Puerto Rico compared to other American states, the debt load is overwhelmingly enormous.
Right.
If you consider it a country, which they, due to the extent that they don't pay federal taxes, then it's very high at about 100% of GDP, but I mean it's not Greece. But I think that the real issue for them is going to be on the fiscal side, that the market's really lost faith in Puerto Rico this year in the wake of Detroit's bankruptcy, and you know the vultures really, really started to circle, and so its interest rates have soared in the past few months. Now they have managed to arrange a bunch of bank loans, which would basically cover their financing needs for a year. So basically what everyone told me there is they're doing a very painful austerity program with a lot of tax rises and hiring freeze and all the rest, and to try to prove to investors that they can stabilize this. If they manage to stay on their target, which is getting to a balanced budget within 2 years, investors might give them a breather. But if they miss and they have to refinance, then you get into this downward spiral of borrowing at higher, ever higher rates, and it's very hard to get out of.
Let me go back to something you said, Dan, that Puerto Rico is not Greece, because I have to say I saw a couple of headlines that said that perhaps it was Greece, and do you want to put an end to that headline?
Okay, well, sure. No, The Economist was one of the publications that said that.
Yeah, I think I did read that. Yes, go ahead.
It depends on which measure you're looking at. It's not Greece in the sense that its debt-to-GDP ratio is not, 160% of GDP or wherever Greece got to. Where the comparison really holds true is just in the it's a very similar macroeconomic story, which is to say that you have a small peripheral economy that is tied to a much larger, more productive one, the U.S. and Puerto Rico's case, the European Union and Greece's, that uses an expensive currency that it can't control and that was the beneficiary of being able to borrow for a long time at very low interest rates because of its ties to that bigger economy. And you also have similarities in terms of a large and bloated public sector, a lot of inefficiency, a lot of tax evasion, big informal economy that makes it very hard for the government to collect taxes and hard for it to cut spending. Mm. So in that sense, in the fundamental sense, they're extremely similar. But Puerto Rico is not yet at quite the dire straits that Greece got into, and its big advantage is that Puerto Rico is much more part of the U.S. than Greece is part of a united Europe, and Puerto Rico gets transfers from the federal government every year that Greece could only dream of.
Let me go back to you, Danica, and you reported that American officials will be going to Puerto Rico next month. Who is coming, as much as you know, and what will be their mission at Puerto Rico? In Puerto Rico,
right? They'll be coming. Well, some of the first people will be coming in early December, and they'll be representing the Departments of Education, Health and Human Services, and Housing and Urban Development, as well as the Environmental Protection Agency. And so the plan is basically to sit down side by side with local government officials and sort of figure out, how federal money is being used and how it best can be used. For a long time there's been allegations that Puerto Rico has not properly used federal funds or that it's not maximizing those funds. And so the plan is for at least the next 6 months to figure out a way to sort of help boost the economy through, better management of these federal funds. And then after that, there'll be sort of an informal review, and they'll determine from there whether more needs to be done or less, or, what the next steps should be. And going back also to what Dan mentioned about, the large bloated public sector, Puerto Rico has taken steps, at least the previous administration, with former Governor Luis Fortuño. He cut roughly about 30,000 public sector jobs in an attempt, to cut back on the bloated public sectors. And in addition, the governor also has reformed the public pension system. It had about a $37.3 billion unfunded liability. And this was a big concern, not only to the government here, but to ratings agencies. And so he was able to cut that liability, which is almost four times the annual government budget for an island of 3.7 million people. So some strides have been made. And in addition, they've approved a flurry of new taxes, which the government anticipates would create about $1.38 billion in revenue.
Mm. Dan, can Puerto Rico declare bankruptcy the way Detroit was able to declare bankruptcy?
Absolutely not. Puerto Rico is not a municipality, is not governed by Chapter 9 of the Federal Bankruptcy Code. It is also not a state, which means that states are sovereign and issue debt under their own law and can rewrite the contracts. Puerto Rico cannot. As a matter of fact, for Puerto Rico's general obligation bonds, which are the highest rank in its structure, there's a constitutional provision that requires that they get paid first ahead of any other obligations. Now, that said, the general obligations are only about a seventh of Puerto Rico's total debt load. The other $60 billion are backed by specific revenue sources, sales taxes, energy bills, water bills, all that kind of stuff. And And those bonds do not enjoy that constitutional protection and could theoretically default. Whether Puerto Rico would let them default is another issue. It really depends on how much, in the case of electricity. So, I think that the single biggest obstacle for Puerto Rico's economy is the state electric power company, which is a monopoly that charges three times the price for electricity that Americans pay on the mainland, and yet manages to lose hundreds of millions of dollars every year. It's basically a giant energy tax on every business in Puerto Rico. And so, given how high electricity rates are, sure, they could conceivably raise them higher to pay the debt, but you get to a point where people just won't put up with it.
Sure. Well, Danica, I wonder how much people living in Puerto Rico depend on money from family members, friends who are living here on the mainland.
Well, actually, not that much. Like migrants from Central America who travel to the U.S. and send millions in remittances a year. Puerto Ricans actually do not send that much back to the island. So they estimate that last year there was some $300 million sent back, and that was a drop from the more than $500 million in the years 2004 and 2005. And so that's one concern, but, Puerto Rico generally has not relied greatly on remittances. But the concern there is, with people leaving, there are less people to buy material goods, less people to pay taxes, less people to help pay off the island's debt. And some economists worry that as a result, the economy will continue to dwindle, especially as the island's population of those ages 65 and older increases.
Well, and austerity hasn't had the greatest track record, Danica, when it's been tried in other parts of the world.
Correct. And again, they are trying some of those measures here, as well as, a flurry of new taxes. And one of the taxes that the government is really counting on, it basically applies to businesses that generate $100 million or more a year. I'm sorry, $1 million or more a year in revenues. And so this tax is expected to raise roughly $500 million, and it represents about a third of $1.4 billion in new tax revenue. And so far, the government has been encouraged. Preliminary numbers for the first 4 months, revenues generated for the first 4 months has surpassed the same amount accumulated last year by $350 million. And then for October, there were $856 million generated in revenue, and that's a $262 million increase over the same month last year. So there are indicators, that they are generating so far. I mean, it's a bit early to say, but that so far more money is being generated this year compared to the previous year.
Well, let's take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. We are talking about Puerto Rico in this segment of Radio Times. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499, and that's 1-888-477-WHYY. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. Danica Cotto, one of our guests, Caribbean-based Associated Press editor and reporter, and Dan Rosenheck, former Latin American correspondent for The Economist. Much more after this very short break. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
In emergencies, children need specialized care. Now, St. Mary responds in a new way with separate, dedicated emergency services for children. Specialists in pediatric emergencies, ready 24/7. A new streamlined flow for immediate assessment and faster treatment. Pain control designed to relieve your child's anxiety. Learn more at stmaryhealthcare.org/emergency. St. Mary Medical Center in Langhorne, supporting WHYY. It's your health. Expect more.
Thanksgiving is all about turkey, gravy, and stuffing, but for indigenous people, wild rice, fish, and game can make a local, fresh, and delicious feast. Writer Hyde Erdrich shares some native recipes and the family lore that inspired them. It's her latest book, Original Local Indigenous Foods, Stories and Recipes from the Upper Midwest. That's next time on Tell Me More.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Next time on Here and Now, we'll speak with actor and former SNL comedian Will Forte about landing his surprisingly serious role in the new film Nebraska.
I heard I got the job, and it was such a surprise, and that's when the terror settled in.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking with Danica Cotto and Dan Rosenheck about Puerto Rico. The island is struggling to stay afloat amidst a sea of debt and bad bonds. How did Puerto Rico get into this situation and what's the way out? And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get, looks like David from Roxborough to join our conversation. And David, go ahead. You're on the air. Hello, David. We do not seem to be connected with David. Perhaps we can get him hooked up. Dan, let me go back to you. And I know that last year there was a vote about statehood in Puerto Rico, and about 54% of the people voted for statehood. Do I have that correct, first of all?
Well, it was that really depends on how you look
really?
At it.
Really? Okay, I thought that was a simple question, but go ahead.
Yeah, it was a two-stage referendum, which...
Nope, we don't seem to have Dan. Let's see if we can get him back on the line. We seem to have lost him. Perhaps we can toss that to you, Danica. We don't seem to have either of our guests. Let's see if we can get them set up. And again, we are talking about Puerto Rico in this portion of Radio Times. And we decided to focus on some of the financial challenges and issues in that on that territory. It certainly faces a mountain of debt. It has high unemployment, population losses. And we were curious about how did this happen? What's the solution? And why it should matter to all of us. And again, our guests are Dan Rosenheck from The Economist and Danica Cotto from the Associated Press. And if you have any questions or comments and you want to join our conversation, again, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Much of the talk on the mainland here, of course, has been on the federal debt and on Detroit's budget problems and other budget problems here, but we wanted to make sure that we were up to speed on what's been going on in Puerto Rico. So we are madly trying to reconnect with our guests. And again, Dan Rosenheck, former Latin American correspondent for The Economist, and he just got back from a trip to Puerto Rico. We've also been talking with Danica Cotto. She's joining us from Puerto Rico, and she's a Caribbean-based Associated Press editor and reporter. And Dan, it looks like we have you back on the air.
Yes, not, we do. I don't know what happened.
I do not know what happened either, but I'm happy to have you back. And we were talking about this vote last year.
Yes. How far did you get in my response?
We got about 7 or 8 words. So why don't we start at the beginning?
Let's start a two-stage vote.
Yeah.
So it was a two-stage vote that a lot of the people who don't want statehood think was rigged by the pro-stateers to generate an outcome. The first question was, do you want a change in status, yes or no? And a majority said yes. And the second was, if you want a change in status, what other option would you like? And a majority voted for statehood. However, if you didn't want a change in status, you either had to pick something you didn't want or just leave it blank. And so it's not really clear what would have happened if they'd just offered a single menu with every option, including the status quo.
But we're talking about a majority, but a small majority, even on under those sort of strange circumstances. How do you assess the view of statehood? And it sounds like the Puerto Rico is kind of split down the middle.
Well, it really the fundamental problem is that there actually is a fair amount of consensus on the island about what people want. But the problem is that it's illegal. What Puerto Ricans want is they want to keep their American citizenship, they want to keep their dollar, they want to keep all the benefits that come from being American. But they want to keep their sports teams, they want to keep their culture, they want to keep their Miss Universe, they want to keep all that stuff. So what they want is, the word they use is a compact, a solemn, irrevocable promise from Washington that Puerto Rico will never be cast adrift, but we'll still let them do whatever they want. Now, one Congress could offer that, but a subsequent Congress could always subsequently revoke it. The only way to get the kind of permanent guarantee they want is statehood. And I think that's why, you know, they've basically stayed in limbo for so many years.
Well, and it's really, in the final analysis, not up to Puerto Rico. It's really up to the U.S. Congress whether they would be added to the United States of America.
That's correct. Depending on how you interpret this referendum, they either did or didn't vote for statehood. Formally, I suppose they did. But it depends completely on Washington. And I mean, there is a bill in the House to let them in that has gotten a lot of sponsors. But I really see basically no chance of that happening so long as the Republicans either control the House or have at least 40 votes in the Senate, because Puerto Ricans on the mainland voted 83-17 for Obama last year, and there's just absolutely no way I can imagine the GOP basically granting the Democrats 5 congressmen, 2 senators, and 70 electoral votes for president.
People on living in Puerto Rico, though, they don't pay federal taxes, is that right?
They pay... They don't pay federal tax on their local source income. They certainly pay they pay federal tax on income that comes from anywhere else. But as a result of that, their local taxes are much, much higher than what you would pay in any American state.
I'm curious about the U.S. officials go to Puerto Rico and try to sort out some of these financial problems. And my understanding is that the poverty rate in Puerto Rico is what in the 40%. What explains that high rate of poverty, even higher than we see in places like Mississippi? Do we have?
Go ahead.
No, go ahead. Did you hear me?
Yeah. So,
okay.
Poverty is being measured by national indicators. Puerto Rico has never been as wealthy as the U.S. Mm. It's always been roughly, I believe, a third of GDP per capita nationally, and typically half the poorest state. So, clearly, by the standards of the U.S. As a whole, a lot of Puerto Ricans will be poor. Mm-hmm. If you look at one big issue is the federal minimum wage applies to Puerto Rico, and a lot of people, including the Economist editorial board, think that's a real obstacle for them because a lot of their workers aren't really productive enough to justify $7.25 an hour, and so that makes it harder for them to compete. But you don't really see, you don't see the kind of misery on the island that you would see, pretty much anywhere else in Latin America because of the benefits of being Americans. Mm-hmm. And a third of the population gets food stamps, they have good infrastructure, they have health care. I mean, there's, a lot of, as poor as they are relative to the U.S., I think everywhere else in Latin America would look upon Puerto Rico enviously.
It's interesting. Danica, who we can't seem to get contact with, but nonetheless, she talked about the kind of brain drain, I guess, that's happening in Puerto Rico. Yeah. Does that concern you, Dan?
Yes, that's a very dire problem, actually, that it's not just... sort of the masses of low skill unemployed that are moving to the mainland. It's absolutely the professional class that just sees bigger and better opportunities on the mainland. And so obviously as they leave, that creates new opportunities for people who are left, which is I think why, although you have this high unemployment rate, you're not seeing big street protests the way you have in other places that have faced these kinds of debt crises. But it affects competitiveness. If Puerto Rico is trying to reinvent itself as a knowledge economy, it needs high caliber people. And actually, its university system is fairly good, at least by Latin American standards. I mean, they in large part because of the history of the farm industry on the island, they put out tons of engineers and scientists, but then they don't stay.
Right. They don't stay because it sounds like there aren't the jobs.
Well, that's a chicken and egg problem, and it's hard to see how you reverse it. Even if there were, as Puerto Rico has gotten more culturally integrated with the mainland, I think a lot of Puerto Ricans are just sort of more aware of higher skill opportunities for them in the rest of the U.S. Than they were in the past. But clearly, the only way that the island can hope to retain these people is to not just get out of its debt crisis, but to get competitive enough that it draws some new investment and creates the kind of jobs that will entice educated, high-skilled people to feel that they can see a future for themselves there. And that's hard for any small Caribbean island to do, but it's harder when you are already creaking under this debt load that is forcing the government to make all these cutbacks.
And that's Dan Rosenheck, former Latin American correspondent for The Economist. Just got back from a visit or a trip to Puerto Rico, and we are talking about Puerto Rico, some of its financial challenges, shall we say, and the fact that it has a fair amount of debt. Its bonds have been downgraded. Pretty high rate of unemployment, its economy in the eighth year of a recession, but there probably are some bright signs as well. And again, we're taking phone calls. I'm keeping my fingers crossed here at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Dan, I'm wondering about tourism and how important that has been to Puerto Rico and how tourism has fared in recent years. Of course, the recession on the mainland has affected people's vacation plans.
Yeah, tourism is actually not as big a share of the Puerto Rican economy as you might expect. There is still investment in the sector because it's less dependent on the local economy. So in that sense, it's one of the bright spots. I mean, there's new hotels going up and places being renovated all the time. But I think that there's a lot more they can do, and they've launched a big marketing campaign in the U.S. I don't know if you've seen the Puerto Rico Does It Better signs. They certainly have them in New York.
I have. Yep.
Puerto Rico has a significant advantage, which is that it is part of the United States. You can go there without a passport. There's a lot of flights. But that comes with a disadvantage, which is that, particularly in the main tourist areas, it's not cheap. I mean, if you're, any taxi in San Juan is, minimum $15. Food is basically what you would pay in a major American city. It gets cheaper as you go outside the city in the tourist areas, but that's sort of the point. So, compared to the Dominican Republic, which is right next door and has beautiful beaches just like Puerto Rico does, where you can get these fantastic all-inclusive resorts for a fraction of what it would cost, to set up a vacation by yourself in Puerto Rico. And I think that, that's another case where the federal minimum wage really bites. Tourism is very labor intensive, and at a minimum of $7.25 an hour, that sort of puts a floor on how cheap it can get.
What about agriculture? I've been to Puerto Rico. It's a very lush island. Is there a future in developing more agriculture there?
Well, I don't think so. That would really be turning back the clock on history. Puerto Rico was originally an agrarian economy. For the first 50 years that the United States had it was all sugarcane, and it was really dirt poor. And America, the government in Washington launched this program after World War II called Operation Bootstrap, which was entirely dedicated to transforming Puerto Rico from an agriculture economy to a manufacturing economy. I don't see how they can really be competitive in that field. I mean, the path forward for them, I think, is pretty clear. They need to as I said, they need to move towards trying to be a competitive, a knowledge economy, and taking advantage and capitalize on the comparative advantages they have, which is they actually have, certainly by Latin American standards, they have a fairly high-skilled workforce, and you know, it's why they're not why, you know, there should be a lot more service exports above all to the rest of Latin America, in things like, well, obviously biopharmaceutical, but also just, you know, anything involving outsourcing. They know how to do it well, and more value added tourism, and trying to promote, you know, clustering, move up the value chain into more research and development, and they have, being part of the U.S. Gives them a lot of advantages that their rivals don't have. I mean, the reason pharmaceuticals set up there to begin with was because, you know, they're governed by American laws and American regulations, but I think they've sort of been asleep at the wheel for, really for maybe two decades now. And the government does have a plan to promote more more higher value development. And the one thing that I think has a lot of potential is medical tourism. There's good medical schools there, and there all their doctors have to comply with all American regulations. And if you're going to get open heart surgery, fly somewhere to get open heart surgery, you might feel a little more comfortable doing it in Puerto Rico than, say, in India. But the debt load makes it tough.
Well, and that's interesting that you say that, because Danica had written about this exodus of professionals, including doctors leaving the island. So on the one hand, you've got medical tourism developing on the one hand, but some of these professionals leaving for the United States.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. Wait times for people who are ailing, need to see a doctor, particularly if you're not in San Juan. You know, people have to wake up in the middle of the night and drive somewhere and wait online all day.
Right.
It's bad. But again, economics is always positive feedback mechanisms. Either people leave and that leads more people to leave, or people come and that leads more people to come. So sure, if you can manage to get the investment in, say, you know, a big hospital that would attract medical tourists from the mainland, then you can hire the doctors and you can try to reverse the trend and turn it around. But it's going against the current.
Well, Dan, we're almost out of time here, but I mean, it sounds like you have a kind of mixed feeling about the future of Puerto Rico. Yes.
I think the short term is going to be tough. There's no two ways around that. I think that I don't think all is doom and gloom forever. I think that, again, they have a unique privilege from being part of the United States and from all their installed factories, their installed education, all the rest. But I think they can get out of it, but I think they'll need help. I think they'll need help from Washington to give them enough financial support, which they can do indirectly through the tax code, basically by letting Puerto Rico tax companies more and then have them pay less to Washington. If Washington helps get through the debt crisis, then I think they can turn it around.
My thanks to you, Dan Rozenek, for joining us today on Radio Times. Former Latin American correspondent for The Economist. After this very short break, we'll be talking about Delaware. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Live Nation supports WHYY and welcomes alternative rockers Arcade Fire to Philadelphia March 17th at Wells Fargo Center. American Express presale through 10 p.m. tonight. General public tickets starting tomorrow at 11. Available at ComcastTix.com or at Wells Fargo Center box office.
On the next Fresh Air, should a pregnant woman be legally punished for behavior deemed to endanger the fetus, as some states are doing? We talk with Lynn Paltrow of National Advocates for Pregnant Women, Jennifer Mason of Personhood USA, which supports giving constitutional rights to the fetus, and Barbara Levy of the American College of OBGYNs. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
when you've got it coming.
An earthquake, a hurricane. The American people have done everything they possibly can. Now it's time for an act of God, and we're getting it.
Michelle Bachmann's morality aside, what constitutes an act of God in an era where the impact of humans is easier to see than ever? That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI.
Today at noon on WHYY. The Penn State SMEAL Executive MBA program in Philadelphia supports WHYY. Professors from the Penn State University Park campus teach in the weekend program at the ACE Conference Center in Lafayette Hill. Information at smealemba.com.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Now we turn our attention to Delaware and its Treasurer Chip Flowers. Questions have been raised in the legislature about spending while on a trip to Alaska. Jonathan Starkey covers state government and politics for the News Journal of Delaware, has been writing about this story, and he joins us on Radio Times. And Jonathan Starkey, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Nice to be here.
You're welcome. And let's see if we can boost his phone up just a bit. I should say we did leave a message at Chip Flowers' office. We did not hear back. Jonathan, let me begin with you and help us understand a bit about Chip Flowers. He is the Delaware treasurer. How long has he had this job?
Yeah, so a little background. He was elected in 2010, took office January 2011. He was had never held elected office before that. He was a corporate lawyer, and the treasurer's office has pretty esteemed history in Delaware. Governor Jack Markell, the current governor, kind of launched his political career there, and Senator Tom Carper, before he was a congressman and before he was governor, also launched his political career in the treasurer's office. So it's been a place for ambitious politicians in Delaware, and Treasurer Flowers got elected in 2010, took office January 2011.
Now, this seemed to start, at least the problems or allegations started involving a trip to Alaska that he took in 2011, so a bit more than a year ago.
Yeah, and there's a little bit more background there as well. He, over the summer, his top deputy, a woman named Erica Benner, took personal leave in June after Department of Finance officials had questioned her on some personal charges on her credit card. We reported on that in August, and she, it turns out she had charged Patriots tickets, New England Patriots football tickets to her state-issued credit card. She had charged a car service to her card, $2,300 in personal charges, and she was forced to resign in August over those charges. And in the midst of this, the review in Flowers' office in the Department of Finance during that whole process, she was asked by the treasurer more quietly. We didn't know this at first. He didn't disclose this in our conversations, to repay some expenses on top of those personal expenses, which included this trip to Alaska, kind of side trip she took on taxpayers while she was there with the treasurer. So we thought it was instructive to look at the charges from that Alaska trip and see exactly what she was paying back and what he was charging at the time. And some people have had questions about that.
And what you were finding, and I should say that I do want to read a statement from the Delaware Treasurer's Office, but it sounds like you were finding that there were trips spending that were not related to the business of Delaware.
Yeah, I mean, I think that he would disagree with that. So what we found was it was a four-day conference in Anchorage, Alaska. Both of them stayed behind a few extra days. The treasurer charged taxpayers for extra days in the hotel in Anchorage, and he says to meet with banks. In the meantime, his deputy, Erica Benner, went off to a lodge, which is about 100 miles away, charged a couple nights in this lodge, a few hundred dollars worth of food expenses and a big car rental bill that got her to and from this lodge. And they say that they were meeting with bankers while staying behind, but they won't give us any tangible evidence that there were meetings. They say if they disclose the names of the banks, it would jeopardize the state's investment strategy. But as you might imagine, people want to know why they were staying behind so long after a conference and charging it to taxpayers.
So at this point, they have not released information about who they met with when they were in Alaska?
They haven't released information about who they met with while they were in Alaska. And it's also worth noting that she, Ms. Benner, repaid taxpayers at Flowers' request for the extra time she spent at this lodge about 100 miles away. And last week, when he, you may have seen, he published kind of reams of travel documents on his website and also disclosed that he was going to reimburse taxpayers for about $450 for when he stayed behind in Alaska, about the same amount for some time he stayed behind after a trip in Seattle, and also $150 or so for what he called food overages, so going over the state's allowable spending limit when you're on business travel.
I mean, it's not a lot of money, Jonathan.
It's not a ton of money. I think people have concerns because this office, the primary role of this office is to oversee money. They oversee about $2 billion in taxpayer investments, which includes cash flow accounts. And I think people's questions have revolved around, you know, look, why can't you explain how you're what you're spending taxpayer money on or what you're doing when you're going on this out-of-state travel. And I think people think little things tell you big things. And they just wonder what was going on here.
Let me quote something that we got from the Office of the State Treasurer in Delaware. Mm-hmm. The Delaware State Treasury has released the complete travel records for Delaware State Treasurer Chip Flowers Jr. over the past 3 years. The verified information release shows no personal charges were made by Treasurer Flowers on a state credit card and that all charges were for official business. Mm-hmm. Jonathan, based on your reporting, does that hold up?
You know, it's unclear whether that holds up. I mean, I think that people have to decide for themselves whether they think that some of these charges are appropriate and whether a statewide elected official should be held accountable for what he's spending taxpayer money on while he's traveling on business or otherwise. So mm-hmm. it seems, I mean, total reimbursements for money spent on the state credit card between what he's going to pay back and what his former deputy are going to pay back already paid back is over $7,000. So, right. And this is money they say they paid back out of an abundance of caution because there were questions about their spending. But obviously they thought enough of this to pay back, you know, several thousand dollars that they had originally charged to taxpayers.
But it also sounded like part of the problem was the reluctance to release some of this information in a timely manner.
I think so. Yeah, I think that certainly lawmakers have... there's been some eyebrows raised about, we wrote a story a couple weeks ago, and he said that travel documents were missing from his office, which is why he couldn't provide reimbursement from third-party organizations. He had said that the National Association of State Treasurers had repaid his office for some of this travel, and you know, separate third-party organizations had repaid. He had trouble producing those documents. He had trouble producing receipts for other trips, and I think people started to wonder why in an office, especially in an office that's tasked primarily with overseeing state money, that they couldn't document or be held accountable for money that they're spending out of that office.
Is this a big story in Delaware?
It is a big story in Delaware. I mean, I think that, people just wonder what's going on. I mean, I think that, you know, when there's a lot of questions raised by every statement that comes out So, and I think that those documents that you referenced a minute ago that he published on the website, mm-hmm. he, for himself alone, there were about 150 pages of travel documents. These include receipts and affidavits where there were missing receipts and, you know, hotel folios and car rentals and room service bills. And so... So there's a lot of questions in there that we haven't had a chance to fully explore yet. So I think it's a big story partly because of the unanswered questions that are out there.
And that's Jonathan Starkey. He covers a state government and politics for the News Journal of Delaware. We've been talking about Delaware's Treasurer Chip Flowers and questions that have been raised about spending and things like receipts. If you have any questions or comments, especially if you're listening here in Delaware, give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Jonathan, this gets kind of into the weeds here, but we're really talking about a debate over things like per diems. Is that right?
I think that the biggest question is whether taxpayer money is being spent appropriately while he's on, while the treasurer and members of his office are on business travel. So are they going purely for business, or are there some charges here that can't be explained because they're not purely for business? So I think that I think that you know, people don't like to see charges on taxpayer dime that can't be explained. So I think that I don't think it's all about per diem. I think it there are some questions about per diem. I mean, you might have seen stories in the past couple of days where the Office of Management and Budget has questioned him about, has questioned the treasurer about the state's allowable spending per day. So I think that, you know, certainly as the Office of Management and Budget is looking into some of this spending as they review a request by the former deputy treasurer to return to another state job. So they're, I think they're kind of getting into the weeds with him. I don't know if it's part of that or semi-related to that, but they're certainly interested in the issue. It's worth noting that Benner, who Ms. Benner, his former deputy, right, who resigned over these personal charges, $2,300 in personal charges, is still on the Treasury's payroll. It's unclear whether she's still on short-term disability. She had taken leave to seek some sort of medical treatment in the summer. But she's still on the Treasury's payroll while she seeks another state job. So she resigned her post to that kind of deputy treasurer position, but she's not off the state's payroll.
Is Chip Flowers' job in jeopardy?
I don't think there's anything to suggest right now that his job is in, that his job is in jeopardy. No, I mean, I think people just want answers on how this money's being spent. I mean, nobody suggested to me that his job is in jeopardy. I think people just want to know what he was spending his money for and what members in it of his office were spending this money for. And but no, I mean, to answer your question, I'm not sure that there's any direct threat to his job at the moment.
And how has he handled these allegations?
I think that people wonder why he hasn't been more straightforward with answers and with documents, and why he hasn't been able to produce, you know, reimbursements from third party organizations, for example, or receipts for other trips. We asked for documentation on a trip to Vermont in August 2011, and it took a pretty long time to get those. And he's obviously pushed back pretty strongly against these stories. But some of what he said has raised more questions than it's answered, because the documentation is either missing or he's unable to locate it or so on. So we'll see. I mean, he's still working with other state officials who are looking into this.
I know there's been a clash with the Cash Management Policy Board, and this is, again, getting probably into the weeds in Delaware. But nonetheless, it's a board that manages a $2 billion portfolio.
Yeah, this is separate from the state's pension portfolio. These are cash flow accounts and some longer term accounts that are managed by the treasurer and essentially used to pay bills of the state, and some of the money is invested more long term. So these arguments he's had with the Cash Management Policy Board predate this travel issue, and there just seems to be some disagreement on who has final say on investment, on how that money is invested.
Wow.
So the board voted on Tuesday, earlier this week, to go to the Attorney General's office and ask Attorney General Beau Biden to settle this dispute. In the meantime, there was a bill in the legislature that came out of Governor Jack Markell's office that would essentially take powers away from Flowers' office and make the board kind of the overriding decision maker on investment policy and decisions.
Is this become a partisan issue in Delaware between Republicans and Democrats?
You know, mostly it's Democrats in charge in Delaware. So
yes.
there certainly seems to be some politics involved, and you know, there's some history to this as well. But it doesn't seem like the treasurer and Governor Jack Markell and his appointees on the board get along too well. Chip Flowers, is worth noting, beat Democratic primary in 2010, beat Governor Jack Markell's hand-picked successor in the Treasurer's office. So some people think that there's some hard feelings that have carried over from that. But I don't know that it's a partisan issue, but there do seem to be some political issues that haven't gone away.
Well, as we know, Delaware is a small state, and where I guess I guess where the political can very easily be the personal.
Right. That's right. And you know, this has always struck me about the Treasurer is that he has not put a lot of time into making political friends during his time in office. Mm-hmm. So I think when a controversy like this travel expense issue comes up, that there's not a whole lot of people that are rushing to come to his defense, and that's unusual for Delaware, which is usually a very at least in public anyway, a place of civil political discourse. People don't usually say tons of bad things about each other in public.
We're almost out of time here, but is there a particular piece of this story that you've got your eyes on, or you're continuing to follow the documents that are released?
Yeah, I think that we're going to look more into what those documents say, and I think it is worth looking more into this into the portfolio and the issues there. When the legislature returns in January, we'll be really interested in whether the legislature and whether Governor Jack Markell, whether they intend to pursue a bill that would take some powers away from the Treasurer's office and how they invest that portfolio. So we're kind of curious what's going to come of all this, but also we certainly haven't gotten through all those documents that he put up on the website last week, so interested what's there as well.
Well, Jonathan Starkey, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks a lot.
You're welcome. And he covers state government and politics for the News Journal of Delaware, has been writing about and following the story about the treasurer of Delaware, Chip Flowers. And again, we did contact his office for a response, and we did not hear back. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moscow. Thank you for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back.